I would say, you know, your parents are the same kids you went to high school with. Once you perceive that and realize that, changes your perspective of everything and you calm down a little bit.
You're listening to the No Labels, No Limits podcast with best-selling author Sarah Box. We focus on the mantra, no labels, no limits, no excuses. And now without further ado, please welcome your commanding coach with plenty of chutzpah and heart, Sarah Box.
Hey there, No Labels, No Limits podcast listeners. Welcome back for another week of the podcast. I'm Sarah Box, your host. And you know, here on the No Labels, No Limits podcast, we're on a mission to help individuals, teams, and organizations think outside the box, innovate, and move beyond their perceived limitation. And that's also each of us can achieve our personal and professional goals, but honestly, just to show up better and more grounded in the world. And, you know, we do this by sharing accomplished and inspiring guests. And each of our guests have either overcome a challenge, a limiting label or belief, and they have moved beyond that to the person you're meeting today. And they're going to continue to do that work as they go forward in life. So let me tell you about our guest today. We've probably been chatting, almost 15 minutes before I hit record. So we've got Charles D'Amico with us. Now, he comes from the Metro Detroit area, and he credits his success to the foundational education instilled by his mother, an educator at Orchard Lake St. Mary's Prep. And after graduating from Ball State University in 2004 with degrees in criminology and psychology, Charles ventured into the restaurant industry. So follow this thread here. This is a multi-interested and interesting person. He ventured into restaurant industry before establishing his first company, Blue Rock Consulting. Motivated by impending fatherhood, he delved into franchise ownership, starting with Jimmy John's. And in just 22 months, so under 2 years, he went from a GM and son of teachers to owning 11 stores and two other companies. So I think one thing that really sets Charles apart is his passion for writing. In January 2020, before the pandemic, he embarked on a journey writing a series of 14 novels known as the Neil Baggio series. And I'm going to ask about that because 14 novels is a lot, and it's only been a few years. But really, his goal is what's inspiring, and that is to exceed a million words written by the age of 40. And this immersion into the world of writing and editing also led him to work on solving challenges in the publishing industry, and particularly for writers who are kind of left behind by the traditional system. So you can see Charles is a multifaceted individual, and I think you're really going to love it, because I know from our early chat, I'm interested and intrigued as well. So welcome formally, Charles.
Hey, thank you for having me. I liked how you said overcoming and being a bigger version than your perceived limits, because that is my experience with myself and so many people around me, the perceived limits we put on ourselves. That was beautifully said. I like that.
Well, thank you. Well, I actually feel that has been true in my life too, right? You go beyond, like you think, oh, I'm good up to this point, and you're going, well, then you need to go a little farther. You have to stretch a little more. But let's go back to you, and just a little bit more from the beginning, because your story is really incredibly diverse, you know, from running multiple Jimmy John's franchises to becoming a prolific author. So can you walk us through a little bit of your background and how the criminology, psychology, and the restaurant kind of prepared you for both endeavors?
Yeah, so luckily I talk fast. So I came from, a traditional broken home. Parents were divorced at a young age. My sister, who's almost three years older than me, took things different because of her age and the world that she perceives at her age, right? I was young enough that I was kind of left behind in a lot of things, but my grandmother was always there. So while my mom was kind of a single mom working, and my dad, and they were dealing with their stuff, I would say, you know, your parents are the same kids you went to high school with. Once you perceive that and realize that, changes your perspective of everything and you calm down a little bit.
Wait, say a little bit more about that, because that no one has ever said that. So my
I'm a walking t-shirt machine. Your parents are no different than the idiots you went to high school with. And when you realize that, it changes your perspective on a lot of things.
give me an example of how it changed your perspective in particular.
When I was in college, I used to talk to my grandma a lot. I'd get off work about 4 or 5 in the morning, and she'd be getting up. You know, she's in her 70s, 80s, so she was up at 4, and it was just kind of like we talked a lot. And I remember dealing with drunks running bars in college, seeing 30, 40, 50-year-olds, right, who are my parents' age or older, acting like kids, right, acting like the 19-year-old kid at a party, made me realize pretty quickly, like, we put people on a pedestal from perception, and we sometimes give them too much credit, which in turn makes us more upset if they don't follow through with this perceived idea that we have. And when you realize they're just people, right? Like they're just doing their best with what they got. It changes, doesn't mean you necessarily forgive people for bad decisions, but it maybe changes the way we perceive the actions that they had in our lives.
Oh, thanks for that. Because I really agree with you, from my experiences, it also takes, it's like, well, man, I don't want people putting that level of pressure on me to be quote unquote perfect. Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's such a powerful observation, but I've never heard it expressed in quite that way.
Between writing and I talk to a ton of people. I have a specific way of talking. One of my other favorite things I say all the time is, you know, I have a tendency to not talk linear when I'm talking to my staff or even friends. I always talk in analogies. And I always say the inner 4-year-old in all of us comes out. And what I mean is that truck, the toy you didn't play with for 6 months, right? And then your cousin or your friend or someone grabs it and you get upset. Like that kid is alive in all of us, whether you're 4, 14, or 40. And you will be sitting at home and all of a sudden someone wants to borrow your shovel that you haven't used in 6 years. And you're like, no, that's my shovel. You know, like we give ourselves way too much credit sometimes. And or other people, and we just, yeah. And
they just, I'm just laughing. It is so true. Like, can I please borrow this? It's like, well, I don't know. I might need it. But to your point, I haven't used it in 18 months. But,
right? Yeah. So it's
the inner foyer. Okay, keep going. I like you. So I'll follow.
I went into psychology because I dealt with a lot of stress growing up. I have openly written about in my book, One Golden Day, which is kind of a therapy book hidden in fiction. It's all the advice I got from my grandmother and my mother over the years before they passed away, and I put it in story form. My sister has now been in recovery. She's been sober over 100 days. But it's something she's been fighting since her teenage years. She's 40. And her perception of how we grew up, right, and my dad, my stepdad, you know, he's like, you guys grew up in a middle income house. I was like, I was the poorest kid in the middle income every place we went because my mom didn't want to take anything from my father, my biological father. She didn't want to deal with the stress. And as an adult, I kind of understand it now, but also I'm like, that's kind of petty, right? Like, I'd rather live poor because I don't want to sit down and talk to you for 10 minutes a week, right? Like, okay, like, just have a conversation, like, just solve the problem, right? And there was a period in our time when we left our house and we stayed at my aunt's house, which was pretty close. But my mom kind of was like, anything you can fit in one bag, that's it. We're not going back. My sister was in high school, I think a freshman year or eighth grade, which is pretty influential in someone's personality traits, right? And character. And to have your whole closet kind of ripped from you at that age. Now she has this fixation on materialistic things. Now she's worked through it a lot and we've talked about it, but that was kind of put on her plate at an age and very developmental part where I was young enough that stuff didn't necessarily bother me. And I was so young compared to all my cousins. I was just used to doing stuff on my own, a basketball in the driveway, a soccer ball in the backyard, cooking with my grandma. So I had different coping mechanisms than she did. And I always say that that's kind of where psychology started, why I wanted to learn. And then I was kind of an outsider. So I watched a lot. I bartended and I was cool, but I was so used to being an outsider, I'd sit back and watch the chaos and just kind of be happy to be there. Right? And over the years, I
I've been in so many restaurant jobs and people heavy jobs where you're interacting with people and work, that I've just kind of tried to take time to learn from my own mistakes, see the mistakes that other people make, not being afraid to ask questions that most people wouldn't ask, which as an adult isn't horrible. But when you have a kid, my son's 10 now, who does the same thing with literally no filter, makes me realize, oh yeah, I've been like that most of my life. You know, I always tell him I've got the beta version. He's got 2.0, so I can give him kind of, you know, the reins on how to get through it. But he'll ask a million questions because he really is inquisitive and wants to know. And I'm like, oh, this is what it's like when people see me from the outside. Because we connect the dots pretty quick and then want to ask the next question. And although restaurants and writing might seem different, they're not, in that if you've ever worked in a restaurant, it's a very expressive lifestyle, meaning there's a lot of colorful language. There's a lot of different people coming together. It's a cornucopia of cultures and people. Like, I actually just finally read Anthony Bourdain's book that he became famous for a long time ago. And he talks about it, right? Like, you have this hierarchy of all these different cultures. Like, this group may be broke when they leave the restaurant, but they run it when they're here. And I think that is kind of a beautiful thing that allowed me to learn from the chaos I had to the things I experienced to what I was able to do as I continued to grow companies.
So I want to back up to something you said that was, it really caught my ear when you said it. And you talked about, you know, being able to ask the hard questions. And then more specifically, you said, like, why would my mom not just sit down for 10 minutes a week, right? To create a situation that was better for her, right, for you guys, right? So how do you use that when you're working either with people or in your restaurants or in any aspect of your business? How has that lesson shown up for you? Because I really think I agree with you, but I also find that unwillingness to sit down sometimes and have those conversations is the problem, not necessarily the problem that you're having the conversation about.
So I usually sit people down and I'll ask them questions like, okay, you obviously don't want to have this tough conversation, but how many tough conversations have you had that ended poorly? Like, let's unpack that. Like I said, my brain goes to the next question pretty quickly. Like, well, why are you afraid to have the conversation? What do you think is going to happen? Let's not even talk about the topic. What do you think is the worst thing that could happen from this conversation, right? And then you try to explain to people, nothing. It's a conversation. More than likely, you're going to get past it, and in less than 3 days, you're going to forget about it. And then some people, well, no, I won't. But no, you will. Your brain is designed to. And I have a tendency to say, not controversial, but I bring up controversial topics to prove a point. So I actually read this at work a lot. And they're like, no, I'll remember. And I go, I'm going to say something. It's like, 9/11 is a horrific thing in our history. And if you live through it, you remember kind of where you were at that moment. And whenever it comes up every year, you're kind of taken back. But on September 9th, you don't remember anything and you don't care. And on September 14th, and maybe, I mean, maybe if you had a family member involved, you are reminded by it. I lost my mother. Like, I don't think about it every single day. That's because my brain is designed to put those things to the side and be like, this is important. If this comes up, we'll deal with it. So I try to explain to people and use these events, like, your brain is designed to forget it. So if it just becomes a traumatic conversation, we'll get through it and you'll forget it because your brain does it on purpose. Like, and the more we talk about it, the less you'll even think about it. Because when you kill the curiosity, it makes it go away. Like, I mean, especially with my kids. You know, I talk to my now 9-year-old daughter and soon to be 11-year-old son like they're 27 all the time. You know, people are like, why do you talk to them, you know, like they're adults? I'm like, because they won't care in 30 seconds if I just talk to them. If I give them some BS reason, they'll think about it more and dig into it. I just talk to them. And we do that with our staff. What's wrong? You know?
So, what have you seen change as a result of that?
Empathy is a big part of that.
Well, I do want to talk about empathy in a minute, but what have you seen when you work with your staff in that way and they get past the conversation? What kind of change or behaviors do you see?
It's cool. I love working in restaurants because it's an unskilled labor job, right? So I get 16 of burnt out 50-year-olds. Like, let's be honest. Like, if you're walking into a Jimmy John's at 50 to be a driver, something went wrong. Like, you may be retired or disability, and you're just looking for fun, which I've got plenty of those who work for us who they're like 60 and they're like, I can only work 15 hours or it messes with this or that. Like, but most of the time something happened, you know, whether you're an ex-convict, whether somebody, you know, won't give you a chance. So we try to have the tough conversations because once we do, it removes this like uncertainty. And then everyone's like, oh, it wasn't as big of a deal as I thought. One of my common phrases, I actually just said it earlier with my wife, was fill the void with information. Don't allow someone else's imagination to run wild.
Yep.
And when we don't communicate the simple things, like I messaged on Slack to all my teams, I'll probably be unreachable for about 2.5 hours. This is why. Now, if I don't say anything, they may wonder what happened because I normally respond, right? If you're an employee who's going to be 15 minutes late, but you don't say anything, well, from the time you're scheduled to the time you show up, your manager's probably like, what's going on? Are they even going to show up? Like, you're creating undue stress. We can just be like, I made a poor life decision, or as I like to call them, PLDs. I was up late, partying too hard with my friends. I will be there. Like, I appreciate that. I tell my crew all the time and managers, if you don't do it more than once every 6 to 8 weeks, if you're honest and be like, I'm an hour late because last night was not smart, I'll help you. I'll get a hold of somebody to make your morning a little bit easier. Honesty goes a long way. And when you remove this stigmatism of just being upfront, it's amazing how easy it is to solve things, right? Because people aren't scared. That's the hardest thing is probably I have to deep brainwash so many people because they're just afraid to communicate. I'm like, man, if you tell me the problem instantly, we don't even have to talk about the problem. We can go to the solution. Yep. The only time we talk about the problem is if I know how to solve it before next time. You know, and so many people are afraid because they're used to getting, whether it's yelled at by your parent or told by your teacher, like, right? Like there's rarely solutions. In school, for example, rarely does a school at any age, if a kid does bad on a test, allow them to fix it. My kids, if they do bad on any assignment, have to fix it to 100. No matter what the school says, because I don't want them to think failing on a test is the end result.
Like I was. Oh, that's so wise, right? You're basically teaching that all the test is a marker of where they are at this moment, and they can move the marker.
It's a snapshot in time.
Yep.
That's all it is.
But that's an important lesson that you're sharing with your kids and with your team members, because we get conditioned or told that our test is us. Like if I score low, then I'm low, right? I'm not worthy, whatever. So, I mean, the life lessons that you're teaching are super powerful. And they seem, I know someone could listen and go, well, it's just communication. I'm thinking it's everything. Because you're rewriting the interior or the internal story people tell themselves.
Let's unpack that statement because you know people are thinking that, right? Well, that's just communication. Words have power. One of my favorite books I reread all the time is Striking Thoughts by Bruce Lee. And the more I read it, the more I realize he was nuts. I mean, he had to be the kind of guy he was. But one of the chunks is, do not even speak negatively about yourself because your body will hear it. The energy will hear it. And I have learned through my kids, I've learned so much from my kids being in sports because you can't do it. I used to suffer from Superman syndrome. Growing up in a broken household, I was cleaning up a lot of messes. My mom and my sister would fight, or this would happen. So it became how I defined my ego. I solved stuff and I felt good. It wasn't until I was like 40 that I realized this is where my, you know, and I started unpacking it when I was like, I can't catch the ball in center field for my kid. I can't kick the soccer ball for my daughter, right? Like, I have to let them fail. And it made me a way better manager because I was constantly carrying the brunt of my company. I mean, I built it through sheer will. I mean, and back injuries and all this other stuff, but I wasn't better for it, neither was my team, until I allowed them to fail. Because when you fail, you get that pit in your stomach. And then the next time you're getting close to failing again, those red flags go off. They're like, hey, you haven't drank water in 2 days and you're running, you're cramping. Remember last time when you were in the hospital? Like, I should drink some water, right? Like, sometimes it takes you doing something that idiotic. But then your brain is like, hey, you know.
Listen up. You don't want to learn this lesson twice. Charles, but you're so right. You are so correct. Yeah. Hey there, everybody. I want to take just a minute out of this episode of the No Labels, No Limits podcast to tell you that we are officially opening the Sandbox membership in September. So if you're not already on our mailing list, please click the link below to either sign up for the membership or get on the waiting list for the membership. And if you click the link, you'll find more information about what's included, what our plans are, and better yet, you'll be on early enough to help decide what is most important to you to experience in the first 3 to 6 months of the membership. So don't wait, click the link below and join us in the sandbox where fun happens. We get to do a little R&R, little learning, support one another, and really grow and expand in ourselves, in our lives, and impact the world in a profound way. So come on over, join us. So let's talk a little bit about the distinction between empathy and sympathy.
This is the conversation I have with a lot of people, not just my staff. People ask me all the time how I don't take things so personal. It actually drives a lot of people in my life nuts that I've been robbed from staff, like large amounts of money, and it doesn't matter. Literally, I mean, I have to solve it, and I hate that part, right? And it's usually in small increments. So, for example, empathy versus sympathy. About 2 years ago, I had a assistant manager that was stealing about 30 to 40 bucks a shift once every 10 days, give or take. And we didn't catch it until like 3 months in. And my area manager was, we got to fire him. We got to do this. We got to do that. And even my wife's got to get rid of him. I'm like, we just want the stealing to stop. That's what we want. Yes, firing them makes it stop with that person. But it doesn't mean the next person we hire isn't going to steal. So let's be honest. So I had a long talk with them, and I was like, hey, it looks like you're living out of your car, and nobody had noticed. And they were like, yeah. And I had, just from driving around a lot, I was like, are you stealing 40 bucks? Because it was only when our sales were really high, like for a day. So you can get a hotel room and take a shower. And they just put their head down and start crying. I was like, next time, just ask for 40 bucks. Like, we'll figure something out. You need like a security deposit for rent. I'll get you some overtime. You know what I mean? And I kept them on. I was like, we have enough footage that if you quit or disappear, I can press charges, misdemeanor or more. I just want you to help me regain that money. Like, what do you mean? I was like, I don't want you to pay me. I want you to make smart decisions that help food cost and labor and grow sales. That's how you can pay me back. Over the next 6 months, not a single issue. They grew sales. They were amazing. I got a text message one night that said, I'm in a really tough spot. I can't really ask anyone for help. And if I go to work, I'm probably going to do something that break your trust. I'm sorry, but I won't be there tomorrow. And then we found out later that she was using again. She's back in rehab and she's doing a good job. But the point was, the theft stopped. I didn't have sympathy for them. I wasn't like, oh, they're stealing. I wonder what it is. It was more just trying to solve it. What would cause somebody to steal 40 bucks once every 10 days, only on days that the sales were so high that they could rationalize, we were busy, we don't need it. And then I was like, oh, car, she's living out of her car. You can kind of tell. And put two and two together. My favorite part of that whole story was a week later, some new hire at another store was stealing. I was like, see, firing her doesn't solve theft.
Yeah. No, but it was, what a great thing to say, I want you to pay me back through, you know, like improved processes and practices, right? Which actually up levels everything and gives
her a lot. So like if somebody breaks something and it's kind of their fault, I'm like, well, this is the cost. And now we just have to work as a team to figure out how to pay for it. Just like you would at home. Something breaks, how do you budget it? Like, it's it. We're just adults. I can't be all like, well, you owe me. You also worked your butt off and got me this far. Like, it was a bad decision. And like, let's figure it out.
And it's life. Things happen.
Yeah.
It's funny though.
He was right. Money, more problems. I got lots of stores, and every time I wake up, there's an issue. Like it is.
So if you take every one of them personal, you're just always going to walk around with your knickers in a twist. So what's the point?
I used to. That's the thing. And one day I was just like, I can't anymore. I just can't. Like, yeah.
I know those little epiphany moments. You're thinking, how long am I going to do this for? It really is non-productive. Stop it now. You know, new story. Stop that. But you're right. It irritates people because they want you to get it. I'm like, oh, that's just terrible. I'm thinking, well, my thing is, it's like, can I do anything about it today? And especially if they're world problems, right? I'm going, yeah, right. Just that wasn't on my list today to celebrate or do anything about, right?
Like, I can make a little difference in my life, but I can't, you know.
I just do it by how I said, you know,
language matters. And I was going to, but went off on a topic, talk about speaking in the affirmative with my sports kids, with my kids in sports. It is, especially baseball, because it is a sport of failure, and my son loves it, and he puts in a ton of work. But you have to teach, you know, at the time, a 7-8-year-old to not walk into the batter's box thinking, don't strike out, don't strike out, don't strike out, but to relax and say, look for a hit, look for a hit. Because when you think of the negative happens. When you think of the positive, I mean, I do giggle when people are like, you have to manifest. It's just positive language in your head that gets you to think of the steps to get there versus the negative language that gives you reasons to not do it, right? These amazing energy. Things like, I wanted a bike and I won one. Chances are you talked to a friend of yours for like 4 weeks and wouldn't stop that you wanted a bike and he saw it and he put it in there. So like, is it manifesting or were you an annoying 7-year-old?
Hey, either way, it worked out.
Kind of both. Yeah.
It worked out.
Yeah.
So you said there's...
I love what I do. I love the people I work with. It's fun.
So you said, though, that, you know, the empathy perspective, that you can talk about how two words can change your world. Yeah? What are those two words? Are you going to keep those a secret?
Well, empathy we already talked about.
Okay.
Would you like to introduce the other one? I thought I put it in there.
I don't know. It just says how two words can change your world is the question I wrote. And I'm thinking, yeah, but now I wrote that a while ago. So now I'm wondering, what did I mean? So if empathy is one, what's the other?
The other one is sympathy.
Okay.
It's understanding the difference of empathy and sympathy. Okay. If we do it in our own lives, I think it makes all the difference in the world too. Because out of the word empathy comes many things, right? Perspective. I'll use the situation for me growing up when my parents got divorced and it was hectic. My stepfather, when he came into the picture, would say things like, I helped provide, you had this house, you had this life, you lived in a nice neighborhood. And then I say, you're an adult in the nice neighborhood. Parents don't talk. Adults don't talk like kids do. We had powdered milk, powdered, you know, government peanut butter, those white cans. I was wearing hand-me-down clothes from kids in the neighborhood that knew it was theirs when I went to school and they picked on. Now, does that mean his perspective is wrong? Or just means mine's different, right? And that's the empathy conversation, to put yourself in someone else's shoes. You can disagree. And you don't have to come to be like, well, especially in the current political phase we're in right now, right? Where it's so far either side. I think part is we've just lost the ability to be empathetic and forget that the word empathy doesn't mean sympathy.
Well, and stake,
I know it's probably an SAT word, but come on, people.
Well, and I think staying curious helps a lot, you know. And I had a conversation with my husband, and I said, you know, sometimes I just hope to be proven wrong in a day. And he goes, why would you ever wish that? And I said, well, it means I'm learning something, right? And I said, you can change.
That's brilliant. He said, I love that.
Well, because, well, he's very, I mean, personality-wise, he's very black. When I came into his life, I said, hey, he goes, no, it's not that. And I go, honey, you're going to start seeing a lot more gray in your life. And he goes, hey, it's not black. It's not white. It's somewhere in the middle. So he's seen a lot more and he gets it. And but it's not necessarily where he gravitates to it initially, right? And for me, I'm kind of like, well, I actually think I know what's right. But if I talk to enough people, I might learn something different. It won't necessarily change what I think, but it might influence how I perceive it in a way that's helpful to me, right?
Yeah.
So I think staying curious and going, what, the example I says, what if all of a sudden you woke up and went, oh my God, for the last 50 years, I believe this and I'm totally wrong. He goes, not going to happen. I go, you don't know. And he goes, not going to happen. I'm thinking it could.
Science. Just look at science, right? Where it's like, this is the way it is. And then after a while, they're like, oh, whoops. Okay, we learned something new. You know, one of my favorite phrases about language, perception, communication, in an interview with Al Gore a long time ago, they said, when it comes to global warming, you know, you've been fighting this for so long. You know, do you have any regrets? He goes, never should have named it global warming. He goes, I thought people were smart enough to understand I was wrong.
See what I mean? That's hilarious to me. In a, but you think about the ripple effect of everything that came out of that, and people get all like, oh my God, I'm thinking, okay, he said he was wrong.
Yeah. It's cold today. What do you mean global warming?
I know.
Like, when you have a fever, your feet can feel cold. Like, let's, I'm just waiting for that argument, right? Like, sir, so I got a response for you. So if you have a 100-degree fever and you, is the cold not real? Right. Like, some things are just.
They just are. I know. Tell me, we were talking a little bit about your eclectic reading and learning patterns, right? Before we went. So talk a little bit about who you're listening to now, what you're learning, and why you chose those particular topics.
Well, I kind of go down rabbit holes a lot. Out of pure curiosity, helping people solve problems. I do, it's not on my bio, but I actually do, I sign a lot of NDAs, private consulting for free for CEOs and vice presidents. It started for fun with a CEO of one of my lenders I had. I went out to a couple lunches with them and was helping them with problems, and that became more and more and more. And they're like, you don't mind doing this for free? I just like it. I like solving problems. I like being aware of things. You know, my ego likes being in the room of a room I shouldn't be in. But currently I am listening to 3 Walter Isaacson books, the gene editing book. I'm listening to Elon Musk's biography, and I almost said Walter Cronkite. It's not Walter Cronkite. like he just died. You know, I'm just getting this video 7 phones for. I'm gonna look it up. But I'm also listening to like Walter Mosley's series. Kissinger. I even started a book on the Medici family, 48 Laws of Power. I like to pick what I'm listening to based on where I'm traveling, maybe what the stress I'm dealing with. Not just to learn something, but to kind of hide, I guess, is a better way of putting it. Nonfiction kind of numbs my brain. Like it slows it. It kind of quells it, because I'm like, wait, what is that? And then I start like hyper paying attention. And they're like, well, this sounds interesting. And then it kind of makes all the noise go away. For me, I actually described it in one of the Neil Baggio books. The way I think is in about 5 lanes, where I think most people operate in like 2 lanes, maybe a third. You know, I will be actively thinking of at least 2 things at a time, like 2 top, and then there's like 1 or 2 things where on the back burner, but I'll still be kind of like, oh yeah, that's right, I need to do this. And then there's this other lane that I've learned to tap into my subconscious a little bit, where I'll think about something, I'll write it down, but then I won't feed it. I won't feed the thing I want to. And then like 2 weeks later, my brain is screaming at me like, you can't do that. You can't start this. And then that. But then at that point, my brain has kind of been, whether I'm sleeping or doing other stuff, has been taking all these other things. And now all of a sudden, without even thinking about it, I'm kind of subconsciously solving stuff.
Yeah.
And I'll just have these moments where I'll be in one conversation with somebody. I'll be like, I got to be right. I'll be right back. And I'm like, I just solved something.
That's the brilliance of the brain, right? In the subconscious, yeah. You give it a problem and it starts to work on it.
Yeah. It's like that Lewis Black, you know, joke you start was like, now I got to figure it out.
You're a pretty good impersonator. So talk about your Neil Baggio series.
So the way I got into writing is different than most people.
most, especially, I mean, I have an editing company and a publishing company, so we see lots of manuscripts. Almost everybody we have met gets into writing because they're inspired by somebody else they wrote, a story that inspired them, right? I got into writing because there's nothing I like to read. That's weird. I was in my 20s. I dislocated my ankle. I couldn't do anything. I had to keep my leg for about 3 months. And I tried reading, didn't like it. Tried video games, didn't like it. I got bored real fast. And my sister kept trying to give me different books. She was a big reader. At the time, she was in her, like, Anne Rice phase. And, you know, where the books were, like, you know, huge, you know, bigger than the phone book. And there's a reference for the audience. Let's see how old you are. And then I was like, no, I'm going to write a story. I'm going to write a book. And she's like, you don't read enough to write. And I go, I'm going to write. And I wrote the first book, actually wrote the first two books in about 90 days. And then they ended up kind of shelved in a drawer for 10 years. And I started writing content for bank blogs. And, you know, all nondescript, you know, I didn't get credit for it. I was just writing for a company. And the editor I had was brutal. I mean, he was cool, but he tore my stuff up. He's like, man, you can write amazing and fast. Do you know what a comma is? You know what I mean? I was like, no, I don't. I studied psychology. I didn't study this. And I was like, funny story. I wrote these two manuscripts. I'd love you to read them. And he's like, they're great, but you need a real editor, right? Like, you know, not. And that started the path. This was about the October before the pandemic. And I started editing Veritas and Ave Maria with more professional editors while I was waiting for them to get back to me, because I was getting impatient and I was liking writing. I wrote One Golden Day, which is the self-help book hidden in a fiction story. And then when I got done re-editing Veritas and Ave Maria, I couldn't stop writing. I wrote Colloquium in like 11 days, Requiem in like 12 days. I ended up writing, my goal was to write 1 million words that year, and I did. I ended up writing 14 different rough drafts, reworking a bunch of them, and I've got 7 out now, 4 or 5, 6 out. And then 2 are currently in their like third round of edits. The other rough drafts, we're working with our editing team, and I'm currently writing a couple other books while I work full time and do all this other.
So Charles, what, not all of those are in your series though, right? Or are they?
The Neo Baggio series is Veritas, Ave Maria, Colloquium, Requiem. They're all Latin titles. My dad's very proud of me in that.
I picked that up.
And then the new book that just released in November called Purdue is a female spinoff character. And those are all French titles. Purdue, La Chaise will be coming out next year. A Trouvé will come out about 6 months after that. And when I was writing this book called Frank's Journal, which we might retitle it to Why I Kill, is the current working title. It's the Neo Baggio series faces, starts off with Neo's mentor, Frank Capilano, goes on a killing spree, and it picks up 4 years after they can't catch him. Neo had left the FBI, started his own private investigating firm, kind of gone down the, you know, the dark hole because he couldn't catch this guy, mad at the FBI, and now they call him back because they have to figure out how to catch this guy. And it's him kind of dealing with all those issues of, do I trust them? Do I use my own guys I built trust with? I need to catch, you know, and him dealing with this issue of catching this guy who killed all these people. So it's a chase. And then the second book follows that, Neo Baggio kind of getting called back to his high school. It's kind of a right turn, but I didn't want to just be stuck on the same storyline. Colloquium picks up where book one left off, same with book four. And then Purdue is a female character that shows up in 3 and 4 that I wrote. Kind of like a more PG-13 spy, something that my kids could read by 10 or 12. While writing Frank's Journal, which is the killer's perspective, prequel to Veritas. How does Frank go from being an FBI agent to killing people? Which was fun. Not really. I enjoyed writing it, but it made me a horrible human being. Like, I was in a bad mood all the time, and I quickly learned I needed to clean my palate. So I started writing this PG-13 series. I swear a lot in the Neo Baggio series. I've gotten better, but there's plenty of colorful language. Purdue is more that PG-13. And it's a slightly different kind of turn. And the coolest thing I got about that book is both my comps were female authors, which is not common for a male author who's writing a female character gets comp to like Jen Ivanovich and other.
Yeah.
I was raised by a lot of cool women, so it's not surprising.
It's not surprising. But I think it's so interesting to hear your process, right, of how you started and then coming back. And I would, when you're reading it from Frank's journal, I would imagine that's a very dark place to have to be in that storyline.
The four people that have read it so far told me, they said they can't look at me the same way ever again.
What I'm does like, that
well,
mean?
That's great.
Because they see it.
It's not a violent book, necessarily. Like, there are some scenes. It's a serial killer book. But it's more the psychological breakdown of somebody who's rationalizing these decisions and then expanding on this bad decision to another one, then rationalizing this killing. Why did he do this? And what is this? And then him coming to terms with certain things. And like, they're like, the fact that imagination or not, the fact that you've had those thoughts to be able to put it, they're like, I'm like, well, I did want to study this for a reason, you know, like,
right.
And there was now, plenty of dark stuff in my past. Like, it comes from somewhere, but still, you know, you're killing people and getting away with it. And then there's a good chunk of the book. I make you root for the guy, even though he's killing people. So,
well, and I think what's so great about that is, as I'm reflecting back on, you studied psychology, you clearly have a good handle on the inner workings of people and relationships. And then you've got the whole criminology piece in there too. So what a journey for you.
My original plan was to go into the military right out of college and then transfer to the NSA. And I destroyed my knee in my junior year. And that even though I'd kind of rehabbed everything and got back where I was ready to go, when I went to METS after college to be processed, they had all my paperwork wrong. And I was like, I'm not signing that. It's not right. And they're like, oh, just we'll fix it later. I'm like, I went to college. I'm not signing a contract that's wrong. Like, no. He's like, well, it could take months for, you know, for us to fix this. I go, okay. And like a week later, I got a job working at a Jimmy John's. Now, you know, it's amazing. A clerical error drastically changed my life.
Well, sometimes as one of the things that my husband will say, he says, it's just a click in time, right? Your clerical error, just a click in time, but it shifted everything, you know? And I can look back in my life and think one decision. You know, like someone said, will you do something? Actually, it was outside of my comfort zone. They said, would you come here and teach this thing? And I'm going, nope, too scary. And I said, I was, because you know what, man? Okay, it's not where I'm around all my colleagues. And it was something I'm not at the top of my game on, but I would bring some people with me. But that changed my life. It changed where I lived. It changed who I knew. It expanded things. But I couldn't know it at that one moment. So click in time, you know? Clerical error.
You know, you're one decision away from a whole new life.
Let's hope it's a good new life. And I get though not being able to look at someone who can think that deep and dark. It freaks. I think it's because it connects us to that place in ourself, right? That's like, I don't want to know it, right? It's normal. We don't want to look at stuff that we're going, what if that's me?
It's kind of like romance authors, right? Like, you know, from what I've seen, most of the romance authors aren't the cover model. So, like, some people are like, wait, where did you get this? Are you living a secret life? But I think it's, you know, I think sometimes too is, you know, I think a lot of people like the dark side, right? I mean, like, no kidding. Like, look at the way news is ran. And I've rewritten Frank's journal 7 times now. Because I know it could be the best book I put out there, it's probably going to be the one that I get judged on because it's different. There's not many books that are written like this that aren't like just some guy in jail writing his memoir, right? Like, so I wanted to do it right. And I've re-edited it. Not just like drastically changing the storyline. I just want it clean. I don't want it to feel fake, you know. But the more we do it, the more it does come off realistic. So it's like, you know, well, it might do great in jails.
But my question to you would be, is that your target audience?
Not really. But I've had enough people ask me, how does an FBI agent become a killer? Like I said, if you put that thought in my head and it sits there long enough, eventually my brain screams, let's figure it out. And I sat down one day and tried to figure it out.
Yeah. Super. Okay, now I'm going to flip it on this. I ask our guest, like you, to listen to other podcast episodes on my show and find something they took away from a previous guest, like some golden nugget that they liked that helped them think differently about something. And I know you said you had listened to an interview and that you had some thoughts about it. Would you share that?
Yeah, I was listening to the Brad Yates interview you did, Releasing Your Resistance and Fear. And he was talking about, at first, I kept saying, like, you know, EFT is like, you know, the stock market. And I went back, and I think I was working out and I wasn't paying attention. And I went back and listened to it a second time. And I remember the two of you were talking about, he had a new seminar coming up. And just hearing somebody else's journey of being able to free yourself from the perception, the emotional stuff that drags us down, you know, it really does feel like a secret weapon when you realize, like, when you can detach the perspective or the perception you feel people have. It was, I think, when I finally realized my own motivation for things, or somebody was, people would get mad at me, oh, you did this on purpose. I'm like, no, the problem is I put less effort in it. That's probably, you know, if I had more effort, there'd be an issue. And I started realizing we all do that, right? The inner four-year-oldness gets mad. You did this on purpose. No, and I think our brain does that because we don't want to admit we overreacted to happenstance, to a random occurrence.
Yeah.
Because if we really overreacted to a random occurrence, then we're the idiot. But our brain does a really good job of defending itself. So it's like, nope, they did that on purpose. You need to be mad at them.
Or for me, I go, did I just do that? You know, did I say that out loud? Was that my outside voice? Because it was wrong.
I'll spookily say, like, red light, let's remove that. I'm just speaking out loud.
Well, I go, do over.
Yeah. I mean, let me re-edit that. Yeah. I do tell people it's okay to be honest, and I do it around my kids and my staff enough that they're starting to do it back to me, like mirroring. And I'll say, this may be coming off as a 9 or a 10 to you, but it's a 4. I've got a lot of other stuff that kind of set me off, so I'm trying to bring it down, and I think you're a little upset because I'm telling you what's wrong. But please understand, this is a 4, not a 9 or a 10. If it was a 9 or a 10, I'd send you home, and I'd work the rest. You know what I mean? Like, so I think being upfront and honest in that perspective and teaching my staff that it's okay, and the people in my life in general, like I always say, I kind of have no shame. And that I have no problem being the butt of a joke or having someone not like me. I would still try to give context. Like, hey, I'm not saying you got to like me. I'm just telling you this was A and B. It's your choice, right? You know, when we were going through baseball stuff with my son, and I think maybe that's why Brad Yates' interview kind of hit so home, is because when you're dealing with your kids and stress, like the emotion, it's hard to detach. But he was on a team. He played really good for 2 seasons, and the coaches cut him and couldn't give us a straight answer. And I found out after the fact, it was kind of because 2 parents behind the scenes were pretty mad, right? And one of the parents came in and he's like, well, I think your son might be, and he used some derogatory term for learning disabilities. And I was like, huh? Like, my kid gets all A's. What are you talking about? Is he a playful idiot? I'm a playful idiot. Like, no kidding. He's a kid. He doesn't have context sometimes. I was like, and he's like, well, I don't want my son acting that way. And I'm like, your son gets in trouble more than mine, even when mine's not around. You think, I'm like, and I remember just being just livid, you know, and realizing that you can't solve everything. You can't, like, sometimes you just have to do your best. And I did the opposite. Instead of getting too mad at him, I remember I saw him like a week later at something. I was like, hey, it was just like, I was like, I had to break to you, man, but that was like not even top 10 most stressful things I had to deal with that day. So, like, I was over it pretty quick. I've learned that diffuses so many things so fast. Like, I hate to break it to you. I'm over it.
Yeah. Well, and I like that you do have a sense of humor about it, you know, because sometimes we just take ourselves way too serious.
I think partly, though, because people read that into us, right? You know, one of the things I love to teach is re-understanding your day in an hour. You're trained from the time you're a little kid all through school. Okay, at 8 o'clock, we're doing this. At 9 o'clock, this. Okay, you go from class from 8 to 9. 9 o'clock, you go to the next. So your brain, your whole life is wired to just what's the next hour. At 9:05, you're thinking, I got till 10. You don't. Right? Like, you, if you can do this in 5 minutes, why are you taking 45? Because you've been conditioned to do it. So I teach people all the time to set an alarm or timer, 15-minute increments, 10-minute increments, any task. You're putting the laundry away, set a timer for 10 minutes. You're messing around on social media, 5 minutes. Not to race, but to give yourself a new understanding, a new perception of time. You will be amazed that for 3 to 4 weeks, how much more free time you have. You're like, I didn't take as long as I thought I was going to take. We take over restaurants. I've taken over 4 different markets. I'll get into a market, and they're doing opening procedures from 6 to 9:30, 10 o'clock. Like 4 hours. And in less than a week, I've got almost every manager doing it in under 45 minutes. And there's no special thing except just teaching them to pay attention to time and just a few tweaks here and there. And all of a sudden, they're like, well, now I got my whole day back. Yeah.
Like, how nice is that?
So it's, yeah. And it's, you know, I think a lot of it is just we have to have enough self-awareness when there's something that's bothering us, instead of just being mad, going, where did it come from? And I think, again, it comes back to empathy. Where did this come from? In your own life. Why am I doing this? Like, I still know when I'm stressed, I want a bowl of pasta. Why? Because from like 6 to 10, every time I came home stressed, my mom and grandma threw a bowl of pasta in front of me. So I kind of need, you know, like, it's been years. Like, you know, it's, if we give ourselves the chance to slow down and ask why, curiosity, like you said, be curious. Where does this come from? Why do you feel this way? You know, it's amazing what you can overcome.
I agree. So with that said, I'm going to give you the last word on the podcast, Jason. What do you want to leave our listeners with? A pearl of wisdom, any of your t-shirt slogans? What do you think?
Give yourself empathy. It's the best gift you can give yourself. Because in your own life, give yourself perspective. The next time you do something horrible or you have a bad day, be honest with yourself. Because you might be like, oh, I don't know why I did this. Yeah, you do. Like, you do. Like, you stubbed your toe because you went to bed late. You were too busy watching something you shouldn't. You were rewatching reruns of MASH that you watched 300 times. Like, you're tired. Like, take the 2 seconds to answer that internal question more and more, and then give people the same chance. Not in an argumentative tone, but just ask. And then put yourself in their shoes. Just did it with my son recently, who's got a kid who's kind of a bully. I'm going to say to him per se, but in general. And I said, do you feel you act to people the way you do because we taught you that? He's, yeah. He's like, so being around me and mom and the things we've taught you, you then mirror that. I said, yes. And so if a kid around you is doing something really bad, do you think there's a chance that he's learning that from his environment? He said, yeah. And I said, well, then shouldn't you feel bad if that's the environment he's in? He said, what do I do? And I was like, and then I walked him through operant conditioning and how to kind of train the kid without him realizing
it. Yeah, but that also didn't set up a us against them kind of thing, right? It's like, hey, but that's a great perspective shift. So everybody listening, first of all, there's a lot of things that Charles shared today that I think are valuable to take forward, you know, from really thinking about empathy and sympathy, having honest conversations, taking the fear out of it, not leaving it to kind of simmer and get bigger and blown out of perspective. I'm sorry, but I'm thinking about some of the things she said. They're so funny. And I'm sure I'm going to share them with other people and go, oh, this was great. But, you know, so if you listen to this and A, you had fun because Charles is a fun guy, but you took some things away that you know help you or will help you, and you know someone who would also benefit, please share this episode. Oftentimes we don't know until someone says, hey, I just listened to this. I think you'd love it. So as a gift to yourself, share this episode with someone you care about so that they can learn from Charles and his knowledge and experience, and we can all kind of level up a bit together. So with that, I will see you all on next week's episode.
You've been listening to the No Labels, No Limits podcast with best-selling author, change agent, and strategic business coach, Sarah Box. You can grab the show notes and find out how to work with Sarah at sarahbox.com/NoLabelsNoLimitsPodcast. We'd love this podcast to reach as many people as possible. Please remember to rate, leave a 5-star review, and share the podcast with someone you think would get value from this conversation. Till next time, keep taking those daily action steps to align your purpose to your principles and achieve your goals in business and life.